Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name's Dave Marshall and joining me again is Tom Fletcher, and we are looking at episode 5 of Life on Our Planet. So Tom, episode 5, what's going on?
So
in 10 seconds.
Well, in 10 seconds.
3, 2, 1, go.
All right, in episode 5, we are talking about dinosaurs and we're firmly in the Mesozoic period. Talking about the evolution of plants, we're talking about the evolution of dinosaurs. Big episode, some big characters, and it's beautiful as well.
13 seconds.
Oh, I don't think it's possible. You know, I mean,
you know,
we got
what?
Down
We've
to 11 seconds, but
there's just too much crammed into these episodes, isn't there?
Yep,
really
too much
is.
Content. Not a bad problem to have, though.
So, tell us how the episode starts.
So this episode starts with the Triassic-Jurassic boundary, that one of the big mass extinctions, probably caused by the splitting up of that supercontinent Pangaea, Laurentia to the north, Gondwana to the south. And as these plates are splitting apart, you've got this huge, great big mass of volcanic material coming up. And with it, you've got gases, volcanic gases like sulfur dioxide, which tend to cool the atmosphere. But more than that, you've got vast quantities of carbon dioxide being released, really potent greenhouse gas, and that boosted temperatures, elevated temperatures. So we're already quite hot in the Triassic, so this wasn't great for a lot of species. And after that point, after that destruction, the punctuation mark of the extinction event, we dive straight into the Jurassic period.
And the Jurassic is where we start to get some of the crowd favorite dinosaurs, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so we've got a really nice sequence with Diplodocus and Allosaurus, which the thing I really like about the series is there are the characters that you're probably quite familiar with, but we do things with them that are slightly different. I won't give any games away, but it's not always the case that a predator has to kill the prey. You know, there's nuance in the behavior there as well, and we see that throughout the series. The presence of the predator and prey are often telling a cool evolutionary story. In this case, it's the gigantism that happens with the dinosaurs. They just keep getting bigger and bigger, this evolutionary arms race which is going on. It's a really moody and quite atmospheric scene.
The thing that I recognize is you doing quite different with, you know, like these fan favorite dinosaurs is the pronunciation of their names, especially Diplodocus.
See, I refuse to believe that there's one way to say anything. This is a free world and we can do whatever we want. As it happened, we did go and get advice on this. We had a professor reading a list of these things to get the correct pronunciation. But, you know, most of these things are derived from Latin and Greek, so take it up with them.
So which other dinosaurs do we see?
In this episode, we really pick some great ones. I mean, we've got a nice scene with Deinonychus, which is pack hunting some Archosaurus, and that was a nice one actually, because we introduce the weird ornithomimid dinosaurs, which are really quite kooky looking. They were a bit of a hard sell, really, to the producers that we should be using that one. It was in the right time, the right place, and it's sort of an ostrich-like creature that looks quite goofy, but I think it's great. I mean, it's got lovely white feathers and a blue face. And the fact is that they just look absolutely bizarre. You know, I mean, Archosaurus is only known from a leg bone, but we've got relatives that we know what they look like a bit more completely. So that seemed like a nice kind of new species to introduce to the world. So we've got those. And then we go into the Hell Creek formation and we look at the favorites, you know, T-Rex and Triceratops and the like.
So Deinonychus, do you mean Deinonychus?
Is that actually how you say it?
No.
You're pulling my leg. Stop it. No way. Not a chance. I'm going to get you to buy me a pint for everything that you correct me on pronunciation-wise from now on. This is going to start costing you money.
Well, how would you say Myasaura?
Myasaura, yeah. Yeah.
Myasauru. Ah.
Okay?
That's just saying every letter individually.
Do it phonetically.
But I wouldn't put it past you.
Well, I mean, you actually did help a lot with that, actually, Dave, because, you know, having somebody who is so particular
annoying?
About how things are, well, no, particular, should we say, about how things are pronounced. it was that that put us onto, you know, saying Dunkleosteus rather than Dunkleosteus, because it's a person's name, you know, and Arkansas is Arkansas rather than Arkansas. So yeah, we were Arkansaurus. It's all good.
Right. Sorry. We also have a lot of interesting other stuff. We have plants. We have insects. We have social insects. There's a lot of evolution that goes on in this episode that isn't reptile. And yes, I was so happy to see all of that in there because it's such an important story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the feet of the dinosaurs during this time was a revolution. You know, I mean, about 100 million years ago, you start to get flowering plants that are taking over the world. They are growing quite literally like weeds. They're capable of recovering from wildfires quickly. They can spread with seeds and you know, pollinators come along to fill those niches. Everything gets more complex. It's kind of a ramping up of complexity of environment, you know, and everything's starting to form mutualistic relationships. And yeah, just it's an incredible time in paleontological, you know, the fossil record. And I'm glad we celebrate it, especially things like social insects, because people might not think that ants and termites are particularly interesting, but you know, this the sequence we've got in this particular episode is wonderful. It shows Megapanera ants, sorry, get my pronunciation right for you, Dave. which seem to be the first animals apart from perhaps chimpanzees, maybe, that are administering a medicine to cure injured soldiers. And, you know, we got that on film, and it tells a really good story, a really interesting story about these super societies that are growing at the feet of the dinosaurs. It's something that hardly any documentary set in the Mesozoic period actually talks about. It's great.
And nobody uses the pun antibiotics.
Oh, no, David.
Could you imagine Morgan Freeman just dropping that in casually?
No, because I think he's got a certain cutoff for the kind of bad jokes that he'd make. Whereas you, all bets are off.
This is why I never got the gig for doing the narration. It would have just been puns all the way through.
Yeah, yeah. the beetle that pollinates the lily was a really nice story too, because we've got a situation there where a really primitive angiosperm, well, not primitive, all the modern things we film are obviously as evolved as everything else. Nothing's really primitive in inverted commas, but they were some of the first line to evolve in the flowers. And we've got this situation where an insect is actually pollinating a lily, and the lily traps the beetle overnight. And, you know, that's a really enchanting little sequence too. So celebrating the small stuff amongst the giants is, yeah, it's so cool.
Mm-hmm. And I speak to Barney Revel again, who's the producer from last time. We are talking about what are my favorite models in the whole series. That Allosaurus in the rain, what a scene. It looks so real. I couldn't believe it when it walks past the screen. And I mean, I've only seen this in 720p. It's going to look absolutely fabulous in, what, 4K? How many Ks? What resolution?
All the Ks, Dave. All the Ks you could ever want. No, I completely agree. I mean, the attention to detail on that model, that texture that I know you really appreciate, you know, that is all detail that ILM put into it, that's why they've got their jobs that they're, because they're so talented at getting those small details right. And to model water dripping over that, you know, that head, it's incredible. It's really, really cool. And, you know, the model itself is really accurate. We talked to scientists about getting the head width correct, because Allosaurus has got, it's essentially a hatchet as a head. So it's really narrow. And it looks bizarre with this really narrow head. It's all, you know, an adaptation to sort of slam down its teeth. Its predation method is really quite particular. So yeah, we got all of that correct. And to see it come to life like that in the rain and the darkness, I mean, it's so atmospheric.
Yeah, it's unbelievable how many paleontological documentaries never show anything at night, never show anything in the rain. And so yeah. ILM, they've got this desk. They've got two dials on it now, one with scales all the way up, one with rain, crank that one too, and you end up with a beautiful texture.
But that it were that simple, Dave. Yeah. It's a lot of hard work, a lot of processing power, and an awful lot of skill too.
A third dial for feathers.
Yes.
Crank that
yes.
up on the Deinonychus. We have got feathery Deinonychuses, Deinonychuses, and they look absolutely gorgeous as well. And I speak to Anjan Buller all about the evolution of feathers, because it's not as simple as you might think.
No, and the feathers, the CGI of those feathers, it is a pretty new thing to deal with, because, you know, the back in the day when dinosaurs were thought to be completely scaled, it was a pretty simple job relatively, because it's just a flat surface really to deal with. But here you're talking about, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of individual fibers, and, you know, to make hair on an animal or a kind of fuzz like Anchiornis's got, is that kind of fuzzy feathers. That's relatively simple, because it's essentially a type of hair, a sort of fluffy hair. But feathers, if you think about it, it's kind of hairs coming out of a hair. So that's a whole new problem. And they all lie flat on top of each other if everything goes correct. So having intersections of those feathers was a real issue for ILM to have to overcome. And I think they did a fantastic job.
Mm. Yeah, we talk about some of the issues with doing that.
Oh, cool.
And the amount of work that goes into it. So I've got my favorite models. Do you have a favorite model or favorite scene?
I think the Arkansaurus is a good one. I mean, it does look bonkers, and I have a real sweet spot for that one in particular, because I just think it's adorable. I think that probably is my favorite. The way it looks at camera, it just looks so gormless.
Like such a bird.
It really does.
Such
yeah.
a bird-like mannerism. Whereas the Deinonychus Deinonychi. It sounds so wrong every time I say it.
Well, I think that's because you
Don't
are wrong.
Pull
Dave,
me up on
you
it.
Know.
No.
Okay, fine.
It's not fair that. So, but you know, they seem so intelligent, so mammalian. And next time out in episode 6, this is a plug for the next episode. We're going to be talking about intelligence.
Ah, great.
In theropods, in dinosaurs.
The theropods particularly, we had to strike a balance really, because you know, living relatives of dinosaurs are birds and crocodiles. And so we had to keep reminding ourselves that these things have to move with quite a bird-like manner. Birds won't have kind of smooth movements. They'll kind of flick their head from left to right, you know, comprehending the world in little staccato bursts. So having that movement in the more primitive ones, and then as they get more intelligent, having a little bit more, I suppose, charisma is the best word. It was a fine line to toe, but I think we got it right.
And can we just take a little moment to appreciate the numbat tongue?
Oh, it's incredible, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, when I first saw that, I didn't believe it. And again, I mean, that sort of shows that real life is crazy sometimes. You know, I mean, who on earth would find a fossil of a numbat and think it must have a tongue that long? It's, you know, it's unbelievable.
I want one as a pet. It's a shame they're endangered.
They are endangered, unfortunately. And spoiler alert, they're slightly more endangered after the sequence that we managed to capture. So very cute. I think they are recovering slowly but surely, but obviously there's been wildfires out there and all sorts of ecological chaos in Australia. So fingers crossed.
And then I guess we better address Tyrannosaurus Rex. This is probably going to be the internet's most scrutinized model for about half a year, I expect.
Yes, we always knew that Tyrannosaurus Rex was going to be a controversial build because people are so I was going to say opinionated, but I think it is passion, honestly. As much as it's sort of when you look at social media and YouTube comments and that kind of thing from the trailer, it is sometimes a bit disappointing to see people really aggressively disagree with the decisions that we made. But ultimately, this was probably one of the most researched assets that we have in the entire show, because we knew that there'd be a lot of scrutiny over it, and we did make the decision to add flesh. You know, it's not shrink wrapped. A lot of people saying it's a chunky T-Rex. Yeah, well, yeah, it is, because, you know, in order to close those giant jaws with force, you need that. And this is a living, breathing animal that would have had, you know, fat on its body, and it needs huge muscles in its tail to power those ginormous legs. So, just to sort of, I mean, outline a couple of the decisions that people are giving us the most stick for so far, just to sort of put my 2 pence worth in. Probably the most important one was covering the teeth in a lip, or a ligament of sorts, so something that is covering the teeth. Now, this was a real problem at the start for the producers, because they wanted to show those teeth, and of course they did, because pretty much every depiction we've seen of T-Rex has the teeth out, and they're huge, they're great big banana sized. And wonderful and impressive, and probably the most important feature that people think about when they think of a T-Rex is those enormous teeth. So to make that decision to have them covered in some kind of ligament was a big one, and it didn't sit well with people for a while. But this is a really good example where the science led us in that direction, because the vast majority of animals that have very big teeth, they do have them covered with some kind of soft tissue. Looking at the species of big cat, for example, those huge canines are covered up. There are some exceptions in the series where the teeth are just so big that, you know, they sort of have to be out. But there was a lot of science that supported the idea that T-Rex needed to have lip coverage. So we did that. And the other one is, I suppose, the feathers. That's a big talking point and debating point. We decided to go for a few filament-like feathers on the crest of the back, just behind the head of the male specifically. There tends to be sexual dimorphism in birds today, where the male is slightly more impressive or has some feature that it uses to attract females. So to have the feathers on the male but not the female was definitely a choice based on modern birds. But you saw that, yeah, we talked about Deinonychus before being covered in feathers. We have really good evidence to support that. We also have relatives of T-Rex that have feathers all over their bodies, but the physiology of that, the way that the body is working, means that after a certain size, when you get bigger and bigger and bigger, you're generating a lot of body heat, and actually having a feather coat is not a great thing to have because you overheat. So there were two conflicting sides to that, which were really quite interesting and definitely needed deep diving on. And we read hundreds of papers about Tyrannosaurus rex to get a consensus of what we thought was right. And talk to loads of scientists about it as well.
So are you worried about any potential backlash?
Of course. The nature of making a program like this, it's kind of like writing a textbook. As soon as you publish it, it's probably going to be out of date. And because there's so much research happening in paleontology, it's such an exciting time to study and you know, be involved in paleontology, that there will be new discoveries, I'm sure, that will rewrite what we know about some of these animals. So we did our best to future-proof a lot of these things. So we went to conferences every single year just to make sure that we were present for the latest science. We talked to experts who are, you know, leaders in their field and knew what was coming down the pipeline science-wise as well. So a lot of the stuff is future-proof in that respect. But of course there will be things that change, and that's part of the excitement of the field, is it's just so active and dynamic.
We're talking about T-Rex. We're talking about dinosaurs. Does it distract from the other narratives in the story? I mean, we touched upon flower evolution before, something that, you know, changed the world forever. But here we are worrying about one species.
Yeah, of course. And there are two sides to this. You have that in natural history filmmaking as well, is that there's a reason why people tend to gravitate towards the lions and the penguins and that kind of thing. You know, things that have been filmed before, but people really like them, and it does engage them with the science. You know, you can not sneak in science, but you can definitely deliver science outreach by showing off these charismatic animals and providing the most up-to-date information about their favorite animals is definitely a way in. You know, it's a way to this whole series is telling the whole story of the evolution of life on Earth. You know, including the dinosaurs is a must, because they were an important feature of the landscape for 150 million years, and they get people through the door. They're like, okay, cool, I'm on board with this. And then we can introduce them to the characters, which yes, I agree, are more important actually in many respects. They're world builders, they're ecosystem pivot points, they're foundations of whole habitats. But you sort of have to have the things like dinosaurs and Smilodon and, you know, giant, you know, prehistoric fish to get people on board with that. So I think they definitely do a service. There's a reason why there are skeletons of T-Rex at the front door of museums, because they get people through the door. And when they are there, you can start talking to them about the worlds they lived in.
And I love this about Loop. We've got a dinosaur-y sandwich. So a piece of bread, dinosaur to start off with. Loads of lovely filling all about everything that mattered in the Mesozoic. Another dinosaur piece of bread. More information, arthropods, social insects, mammals appearing, yeah. Snakes, and a bit of dinosaur bread to finish off. It's a lovely sandwich for everyone to enjoy.
Oh, I'm glad you think that. Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's a really nice episode for contextualizing the dinosaurs and, yeah, meeting those characters that evolved, you know, during the time that their famous counterparts were roaming around and roaring and all that kind of jazz.
So without further ado, we should probably all have a listen to some of the interviews about this episode and stop listening to me talking about dinosaur sandwiches. So I'll see you in the intro to episode 6, Tom.
See you there.